welcome to Elite Cadre, the Hordes of War Machine podcast that doesn't take itself too seriously.
Yay!
Are you trying to interrupt again? Really, really? Are we on the thousandth interrupt?
Yeah, because you got through it.
I'm Alex.
I'm Kurt.
And I'm Nick.
Well, at least we got this far.
We don't know who he is, but he keeps trying to talk.
He just turns up every week. It's kind of weird. I'm especially given as we record every other week.
He was talking about you.
Fair enough.
Sure, he's talking about me.
This week we'll be looking at Horlock Doomshaper, Shaman of the Gnarls, and giving you a brief guide to how to survive your first 6 months in War Machine.
Avoid Nick.
Really? We're going there already?
We'll go there several times, if you don't mind.
Fair enough. I thought what we'd do, first of all, is just like, you know, a complete separation from normal, is we'd do some news. We've seen some new models on the PP site. Let's start off with the Gobber Tinker.
It is groovy.
It looks like a really nice... From what we've been told, it's one of those spare time projects that someone's gone, that looks really nice. Should we make some rules for it?
Do you know what I think? I think that thing, it does look like he's very, very good at repairing my war wagon.
You may not necessarily be able to keep up with your war wagon, but, you know, it's...
You just hitch that little train up to the back of it and jump on.
Yeah, valid.
So you're insinuating that your wagon has tow now, are you?
Yeah.
Why not?
Fair enough.
Show me where it says it doesn't.
Yeah. No, it's a nicely sculpted little model, plenty of little bits and features, including his little portable furnace, which some people thought was a Warcaster backpack, which was all sorts of levels of wrong.
Yeah, well, it was initially spoiled on Twitter quite a while ago. I think it was Matt Wilson who posted a picture up of it, just sort of saying, what do you think of this? And that's it. It's kind of the speculation was it something for the IKRPG, or was it for the, this is even before we see Gargantuan's released, or was it a Gobber Warcaster, or, you know, there was...
I think
abound.
It's something that's very applicable to the IKRPG.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Because, you know, if you're playing with models, absolutely perfect.
Looks like it'd fit in the IKRPG. It's a very characterful model.
Yep. Yeah, there's potential also to, if you're of a mind to it, chop it up and use it as scenery. You've got a nice load of bits there, with sort of barrels and furnaces and spare wheels and whatnot. So, you know... Plenty of stuff
interesting to see if they are separate components, or if that is just kind of like maybe a large resin insert that goes in the back of it, maybe, or, you know, you see how it comes in part form, which could potentially, like you say, make some...
Well, it is apparently from the page all white metal.
Is it all white metal?
Yes. I believe there have been some comments on the pricing.
It's rather expensive.
Which, it's $22. I don't know how that translates to what the prices we normally get.
I think you're probably going to be looking around £10 with, you know, after conversion and all that stuff.
I think probably a bit more, because we're not at 2-1 with the dollar. I'd actually be hedging.
I know, of course, yeah.
Yeah,
it happens occasionally, but not for a while.
I think it would be more around the 16, 17 area.
Yeah.
But,
It is on a large base, though.
Medium.
Is it medium?
Yes, it is medium.
40mm.
However, it is a medium base, and it is overhanging on both edges and pretty much fills the entire volume with metal.
It's made to go in Troll Army, that's what it is.
Pretty much.
Why? Because it's ridiculously overcosted money-wise. Like those room bearers.
Yeah.
Well, you say ridiculously overcosted.
That sounds about right.
When you think about the hobby as a whole...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a cheap hobby. Something that Conrad is particularly fond of saying quite often.
Who?
Conrad.
Some old geezer from London.
It's him, Conrad, of Grumpy Wargamers.
I'd never really heard much
of Manifolds.
Well, of both. So, anyway.
I'll take your word for it. I don't really know who that is.
We've clearly run into things to say about the Gobber Tinker, so let's move on to the next one on the list, which is Axis, the Harmonic Enforcer.
Oh my god, this guy is so boss.
Is this Nick Gush time? But...
Oh my god, this guy looks so cool.
If he had a hammer.
He has two.
A hammer in the morning.
Yeah.
I just love everything they've been doing with this guy. Because, I mean, his two hammers are called Action and Reaction. And he's got Beatback on them and Follow Up and the Combo Slam. Oh, my God. So cool. Can't wait to get this guy.
I think that's what I've heard.
So if we're going to talk about the actual model, though,
he's one of the two humans as well. I mean, the model doesn't show off his humanness. He's hidden away in armor. You could
doesn't
quite
show off his human nature.
Well, because he's one of the few podcasters that's human. Aurora's were the other one.
It would show off his human nature better if he was like hugging a kitten or stroking a puppy or something like that?
But like, if he had, so at the moment he's just entirely armor, he could quite happily be a robot. But yeah, whatever. He looks boss, man.
Okay, there we go.
Do you want me to do some like real feedback of it? I think the backpack is really cool. That sort of it helps with his arms, I assume, to make him swing harder. I don't know.
How many of those models?
Swing what?
Swing harder.
That's what his mum and dad do.
Apparently.
Only at certain parties. Car keys and the bolt.
In the 80s. With also, his elephant fur.
They've
that
tried to go too skinny with his armor. His armor looks bulky. Like in the legs, it looks as though he would be unmovable.
Maybe just put him into knockdown.
Well, we've seen some of his rules.
How many of those models are going to be missing the pipes?
Yeah, probably quite a few.
People just sit there and go, do I really need to glue these on? I'll just put some green stuff across the holes and it's fine.
Well, I can imagine there being some cool stuff down his back, but obviously can't really see that at the moment, can we? It was a 3D version.
Yeah, I think there is a 3D version.
It's got like a cape thing at the back and stuff and... It's got a spare helmet clipped to his belt.
It's got that kind of weird loincloth that seemingly everything space in a robotic marine suit must have.
It has a whole kind of space marine thing going on. It looks almost like a spare helmet at the back and bits. It looks like, moving on.
It's got Norse flags.
Yeah, it has, yeah, too.
And some grenades.
And some purity seals and some skulls.
There are skulls all down one leg.
Oh, damn.
We may be lying at this point.
Well, I'm not, but you might be.
Okay.
Kurt never lies. Especially about their big Welsh Open tickets on the sale.
They're still available for...
still available for the event that was how many weeks ago now?
3, but they're still available.
Is it me, or does he look like he's got sort of the bottom half of a dead frog hanging off the back of his belt?
It does, it's awesome! head strapped in the belt cup buckle at the back.
I can't unsee it now.
the front's the same, when you go back to the front, it's kind of the same. Good.
Okay. Let's move on rapidly.
Him for me now. He's gonna have to ruin your face.
As the expert of the convergence, is it that he's so heavy that his feet have been pushed into the ground? Because it just looks like he's chopped off at the ankles or something.
It's just that he's got like the really really thick armor. Yeah. I assume got sort of like
the reason he's got no feet is because he's actually a Fire Emblem character.
Oh my god. No.
Yes. See, very few people will get that, but it's fine. We can just move on to the next one, which is the Diffuser.
Oh, the Diffuser. That's the Dave Robinson robot, isn't it?
Why are these all plastic when it's all metal, I don't understand?
What, all the kits and things?
Yeah.
All... What's wrong with that?
Don't get it.
Hang on, no. Have you learned nothing from Grumpy Wargamers? They're actually Res-tic. They're not plastic, because they're that weird resin plastic kind of thing.
You felt that was worth saying, did you?
You did.
I'll be honest, sometimes it's worth saying, you know?
Okay.
Otherwise, we'll get emails.
Good. Send all emails to Nick Topham.
Or elitecadrepodcast@gmail.com.
For the attention of Nick.
There we go.
It's all right, Alex will reply to them.
Yes. And then send more missing parts emails from the podcast address.
If you want Alex to reply, send it for the attention of Nick. And he'll reply, pretend to be Nick. For sheer comedy value. You can tell it's Alex, because you can hear the little drill in the background when he's typing.
Quiet, you.
Anyway. Danger Will Robinson robot.
Yeah, very.
Danger Will Robinson. Danger.
Really?
Come on, look at it.
I agree.
Look at it properly.
Well, apart from it's got no caterpillar legs, and it's got, you know, sprint with things. But yeah, I can see what you mean, putting the head and stuff, yeah.
See, I go to my brain looking for the Lost in Space robot, but I always come back with the one from Forbidden Planet instead.
They're very similar.
They are. So
it's pretty funky. The Diffuser's pretty cool.
Purists would slag me off for that, I'm sure, but I think they're very similar.
The main difference is that one from Lost in Space is kind of a more bulbous, sticky out head.
And isn't a weird interpretation of a strange caveman creature.
Yeah.
Now there's an obscure reference for you.
I believe Robbie the Robot looks more like he's been shoved in a pencil sharpener.
Yeah, but he's basically Caliban, isn't he?
Yes. Little bit. It is the Tempest, but yeah. Anyway, before we dissolve into film references,
We haven't said Terry Gilliam yet. We could say Terry.
Anyway,
love Forbidden Planet, but you know,
I like Leslie Nielsen in a serious role.
Ooh. Oh yes, no, stop it. I know what I can get you
back. I love how to derail you when you're really focused. It's great.
We'll move on to the Trollkin Warders.
Oh, yes, hello.
We can talk about the Angel Robinson robot. Fine.
Oh, is there more you want to say on the
DQ? I was going to say, it's not the one... this is the one of the three lights that's not in the battle box, but it's probably going to be the one we'll see the most. So get used to looking at it.
Why? What does it do?
It gets to add... It does what Grim's Gun used to do. Or Grim Wand's Gun does.
Oh, when it hits something, you cross 2 speed.
Cross 2 speed towards it and charge for free, yeah.
Lovely.
Hunter's Mark.
It's called Luck, I think, or something like that.
Right, so, yeah. Warders.
Yes.
I thought it'd be bigger.
They're hanging over the edge of medium bases.
I think
what more do you want?
A bit bigger. Thought they'd be bigger. But they are nice.
I think they look like they are extremely hefty, which is just about the right place where they need to be.
I like it a lot.
Yeah, I think they are lovely models.
I'm a huge fan of them. I don't know what it is about them, but something just doesn't click with them with me.
I think rules
are awesome, but the models, I just kind of looked at them and went, oh.
Well, you look at the bodies, and the bodies, I think what it is you're going to have different arms and heads, and the bodies will be champion bodies, because they are kitted out champions.
Yeah.
So the arms will be different, and the heads will be different.
If you're getting that kind of plastic unit.
Yeah.
Very plastic then as well.
You've got, I think, at least a couple of bodies that are leaning forwards, like the old metal champions that did, you had a couple that were sort of running forwards and... Yeah, I think that they're in about the right place for it.
That's a hell of a lot of armour. It's so nice to have such heavily armoured infantry.
Oh, and the rules are awesome, but something about the models just doesn't click with me.
Very weird to see a mix of weapons as well.
Just kind of trollsy champion thing.
Well, you've kind of got sort of...
Cruel warriors have mixed weapons. Fens are the only ones that don't, really.
Fair enough.
Of the main units. Fens have all the same weapon, but cruel warriors have a mix. Champions have a mix.
Yeah, they're hammers and axes, aren't they?
Yep.
Champions.
See, the only one I'm thinking of in Kador is
Cossacks.
I know, but I'm thinking of sort of cross-factionally. It's very rare you actually find mixes of weapons and units.
I think it's a small thing, generally. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the other factions are more military organised.
That is true.
Demi's like the orcs.
Oi, they is not.
Should we move on before he gets offended? Well, more
offended. I'm upset now.
Yeah. Let's move on to one of his favourites, the Troll Bouncer.
That's a nice plastic. I don't like the new plastic lights, but I like that one.
It looks very big and angry and chunky.
It looks like the model for the new lights. They took the bouncer and then made all the rest of them fit it, so it looks good. But I've already got two, so...
Well, you've got your custom one that is... No one would look at it and go, that's clearly not a bouncer.
Except it's got almost no bouncer bits in it at all.
Yeah, it's like, really, very clearly is a bouncer.
It's got a bouncer shield.
None of it's the bouncer, but, you know...
It's got a bouncer head and a bouncer shield, and that's it. And it looks... I'm very happy with that.
It is very nicely done, Kurt.
Thank you very much.
But yeah, this is just a heavily armoured troll with a very big shield and a big spiky ball.
Oh, plastic shields that you can't buy individually.
Yeah.
Unless you had a mispack.
Not that we're suggesting anything.
Here at Lee Cadre, we could not possibly condone you saying I had a mispack just to get 28 shields.
We do not condone it, we do not endorse it.
I bought 28 bouncers and not a single one had a shield.
I do not really want to plaster the side of my war wagon with...
I feel I should specifically comment that as a PG I can't comment at this point.
No, it's not the thing
that would
look
really cool though.
The replacement parts service that Privateer Press offers is fantastic, and they do a no questions asked system of, you know, if he's miscast, they'll sometimes ask you to send them a picture. I think that's more just to kind of so they can see what's happened.
We would also say that if the missing parts address is abused, then there is a potential.
But that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
They should ask you to take a picture of the parts that's missing.
Frequently, they have started to, I think.
What, if you've got which bit's missing? Take
oh, obvious troll is obvious. to some people, anyway. No, but the point of what I was saying was, it is a fantastic service they offer. So, in all seriousness, don't take it for a free ride, because if you do, then it'll go away eventually.
Yeah,
if you do, we won't be able to.
So, should we take this a cue to move on to the next piece of news?
Yes.
The reptile hands. These are interesting models. They aren't quite what I thought they'd be.
You're not impressed then?
I like them.
Hmm? No, I'm trying to be like a lizard.
like.
Oh, I thought you were sucking your teeth. You didn't like him.
Yeah, he's just going a bit odd over there in the corner.
Going.
Have you had too much sugar today?
I've had no sugar today. I've cut all sugar out.
But you haven't.
I have. Well, all non-natural sugar.
Are you down to just like 7 cans of Monster a day now?
Nope, none.
Okay.
I've only been drinking water all day.
Sugar. It's quite difficult not to have any hidden sugar.
Yeah, yeah, no, natural sugar and stuff. But yeah, and yeah, probably sugar in some things, but yeah.
Okay.
And you do need some sugar to live.
No, you don't.
No, you don't.
But you do sugars, but not necessarily refined sugars.
Yeah, I had an apple.
Anyway, on to the reptile hounds.
Quite funny.
Yeah.
They come in ugly. Ugly.
I love them. But I think they're pretty cool.
Then again, a lot of scorn is U-G-L-Y.
They ain't got no alibi. They ugly.
Ugly. They ugly.
Who cares? They're like going to rip your face off.
I think they're doing a very good job of sort of portraying what they're meant to be, which is angry little lessers that will snap your ankles off.
Are they supposed to be baby things that have an arm snapped on them, or are they just small beasts, Alex?
I don't know. Nick?
Good answer.
I don't know. I've not read the fluff on them much.
You're the score player. Alex.
Me?
No, Alex.
Really? Wow.
Alex is a lapsed Scorn player, please.
Quick, let's get JD Whitey on. He'll know.
No. They certainly don't look like smaller versions of anything else. So, but again...
They're just like tortured, twisted lizards, really.
But they don't look that tortured.
That's because the armour hides the torturing. Yeah. They learn, you see.
True. But yeah, they look that'll be... I don't know, nice things for Scorn. lots of armor, actually.
Yeah, everyone does have any nice things.
Yeah, nice things for Scorn, you know.
It's the most nice things for Scorn players.
Oh, I'm sorry, Alex. You are, after all, being the most vocal person for Scorn model reviews, who we normally go to and you go, it's all right.
Yeah, but only your kind of response there was like, I can't really say anything constructive here, but I don't want to say anything bad. Yeah, that'll be a nice model.
I think they're cool.
They're ugly.
I think they've got their alibi. Aesthetic perfectly well, thank you.
I think being on 30mm, it's a bit deceptive, the picture, because it looks like there might be some areas for...
They're lessers, they should have been on
30mm. Yeah, I'm saying, they're on 30mm, and it looks like from the pictures that there might be some area for freehand, but it's going to be quite small given the size of base they're on.
When are we going to get... we've got pigs. I was going to say, when are we going to get troll lessers, but we have pigs instead, I suppose.
Yeah, that's all you're getting. The last piece of news is that we've seen the box art for High Command.
Yay!
Card.
Boo! Okay. Crappy art.
It's not bad.
It feels very much like Mark One art.
It does, yeah.
More than anything.
Stylized art. I just don't read Terminus. I couldn't even see it was him for ages. Actually, until we discussed it, I couldn't tell it was him.
It's the CGI kind of.
At first, I thought they just like pulled the characters from the video game in development. Like, did anyone see the April Fools that they did?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like the same ones that were on the front of that, which I thought had been thrown together for the April Fools.
It looks like very cleaned up attempts at not quite photorealism, but close.
It has a kind of
Mills and Boon?
Final Fantasy kind of thing going on to me. Makes me think of that.
It's that kind of CGI stuff that takes a real picture and then adds stuff into it.
Yeah.
So you'll get like I really don't like it. I really don't like that style of art. I just
It looks like a Richard Linklater film.
Who want to?
Yes. Just say yes.
Yes.
Just, if you get the time, Alex, watch In a Scanner Darkly. It's fine.
Oh.
There we go. See? I got it.
Oh. I like In a Scanner Darkly.
It is a very good film. Bizarre, but very good.
Good.
What yes.
In a Scanner Darkly.
A Scanner Darkly. I could explain the reference, but it'd take ages.
Anyway, it's been priced at $45, so some pounds.
That's about £10, I think.
Very
once conversion's done, I think that's going to be about £10.
Okay, fair enough. And 400 cards between a mix of all the factions.
So 386, actually.
That's about 400. It's fine. Which is about on par for other deck builders like Dominion and Thunderstone. So
is that the kind of, I don't know what it compares to, as in what other games are like this, but you've answered the question really.
Yeah. Well, that's what we think it's going to be similar to. Sort of
I don't know what a deck building game is out really.
You kind of have central pools of cards and you buy them for your deck, and it's a very odd concept. You kinda need to play one rather than have more than have it explained to you. Which really does defeat the point of the podcast at this point, if I'm honest.
Don't do that.
Go and buy it, play it, have fun.
Somebody else will buy it, and I'll play it at some convention thing.
We can't buy it and play it at this point, because it's not out until well after Lock and Load. So,
well, there you go, then.
They're Ninja. There'll be a pre-sale, I'm sure.
I think the target was Gen Con.
Okay. We know there's a Hordes version in development as well.
Yes, because they put the art up for that. Well, they've put an art preview up for that on the page, so we can see who's going to be in it.
Yeah, you go on the page. One side of it's got the War Machine artwork for the... That one, and then the right hand side, he's got the what looks like the Hordes artwork.
Yeah,
it's just Scorn. I haven't got a caster though. That's the only disappointing.
You're just obsessed with the fact that is just a generic Scorn trooper, aren't you?
Yeah, everybody else gets, there's Stryker and Iris and Fuhrer and Terminus and Kaya, and then there's just a random Scorn bloke.
You saying all Scorn look the same?
I am racist against Scorn. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
It's like you're racist against dwarves as well.
That's not so much racist as... Have you met me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sadly.
Yeah.
Burn. Get that man to my low beer.
Okay. So I think that is all the releases we've got.
Is that all of them? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah?
No Call to 48. Go buy it. It's full of serious goodness.
It's seriously full of goodness.
Oh, just... Ah. Oh. Really? You had to make that pun?
I did. Sorry.
I didn't get it.
You're probably one of the lucky ones. Right, we should probably
move on.
Obvious
troll is obvious.
Yes. We should probably move on to what approximately.
Trading the casters?
No battle reports. I've told you that before. We should probably move on to our main topic of the week.
Do I have podcasts every week? Nobody told me that.
What of this week's recording?
Oh, sorry.
Get with the program, Kurt.
Does that mean I have to listen?
Well, occasionally. Alex doesn't. So.
I do what I can. I don't make no promises.
Yeah.
So I just want to say something.
Something?
You just did. Done. Moving on.
Yeah. Topic for this week is important lessons to learn in the first 6 months of playing War Machine.
Is that because we know that most of our listeners have not really played very much?
I don't know. Some have been playing quite a while, but, it could be helpful things for them to pass on to others.
Oh, okay.
See? Things like the... The most important one in War Machine of protecting your caster or learning to lose a lot, repeatedly, week after week.
I think that's the one thing a lot of people don't realise when they get into War Machine is that your first few games will against, once you get out of the battle box and once you get into playing, you're going to lose and you're going to lose hard.
You'll have your demo game where hopefully the other person playing will at least make it look like you have a chance to win and probably let you win. Which is nice. And then after that, they'll go, okay, now we're going to play hardball, and you're going to see just how easy it is to die in this game. You'll be wiping your caster up with napkins for a while. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just that...
It's a thing, though.
Yes.
It's a cruel, heartless world out there.
Well, exactly. And it does put a lot of people off, if I'm honest.
Put me off.
But if you can get through that sort of that starting period... And learn, okay, I've lost. Let's look at that game and how could I have played it differently? What could I have changed?
You could have won.
Well, yes. So it's
the best place to start.
Or even asking your opponent. That's a good one. It's like, what could I have done that I wouldn't have lost so horribly?
Stayed at home.
There have been tournaments, particularly ones where I've taken mercs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Today has gone badly. I will put everything back in the case and pretend I was never here.
You didn't see me, right?
Yes, quite. So it's an important lesson to learn, to be honest.
Pretending that you weren't at an event.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work so often these days, because people know who I am.
People know me? Are you saying you're kind of a big deal?
Well, to be fair, Kurt, they can see you coming.
You know
so
who I am?
I haven't had to use that line yet. So
I suppose the other thing I was going to... A really important thing at the start especially in new metas, is to play lots and lots of small games to start off with. Play at least 20 battle box games before moving on to any infantry or anything else. Just play so many little local groups that I've sort of played with. I mean, everybody wants to jump up to 35 or even 50 points really quickly. Some people have got the funds to do it.
People look around when they first start, they go, okay, well, a lot of the events at weekends are like 35 points, 50 points. Well, I've got to get there as quickly as possible. And that's not really how the game works. You need to learn what each individual piece of your stuff does before you move on to something else, and learning what warjacks can do and what how casters can swing a game.
Well, I think the dynamic, the actual war, but the battle group dynamic is one of the hardest things to learn in compared to other games, because there isn't really anything comparable in other games that I can think of. So, and how much changing it, and even then, you play Battle Box games, the next thing to do probably is to put a different caster into one of the Battle Box games.
Yeah.
Because that will change, as you, exactly as you just said, it changes to understand how much it changes how everything behaves. I mean, obviously the Cirrus convergence is even more so, but that's more of an exaggeration than anything else.
Well, and just to take an example from Kador, if you switch the Kador battle box from P. Sorcia over to P. Vlad, the difference is huge, because suddenly your jacks that, you know, can't really hit anything and are quite slow most of the time, but will get in and have one good turn where they will automatically hit, change into having this huge alpha strike over a lot of the other battle boxes.
Yeah.
By alpha strike, we mean actually getting the first hit of the engagement in. It's, you know, it's a term that gets used a lot, but never really explained.
No.
So I have.
Especially by the podcast. I don't know. Rich, you're missing the trick now.
Yeah.
Alpha strike. Explain what alpha strike is every episode.
Exactly. At the start of every episode, as the introduction.
Absolutely.
See? That's how it works.
Pro tip.
But I think you're absolutely right. You need to learn how your battle group interacts with each other, and sort of, you know, what point you maybe have to cut back on spending focus or fury, and things like the limits of the control area.
What are your guys' views on... See, I don't like to call them two games, but they are essentially two games, Hordes and War Machine. I tend to kind of say to people, you're better off starting out the game with War Machine, because the focus mechanic is easier to get your head around than the fury mechanic, in my opinion.
I think that's an interesting assertion. I think more important than starting with either Hordes or War Machine, I think more important is that you are facing off against someone who's playing the same system.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, if you and a mate want to start getting into this game, play the same one.
Yeah.
Pick one or the other. I started with Hordes, and my mate at the time, I bought Trolls and he bought Scorn, and that's how I started this game. We just played quite a lot of games.
Yeah.
But it's because...
If only there was a two-player battle box that they made.
Yeah, that'd be a really good idea.
Well, to be honest, if you're in your first 6 months, that's a great place to start these days.
Yes, it is.
Because you're getting everything sort of all in that one box. But now, if you're starting off with one player playing Hordes, another playing War Machine, neither of you played the games before, you've kind of got two separate rule books and systems. It's like, well, one of you can boost outside the control area as long as they've had focus put on first, and the other one, if they leave it, they can't boost at all, and the systems versus the aspects are completely different, and it's very hard to learn from what the other person is doing on the table.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, you sort of switch round and play the other side. And then it can potentially get a bit more interesting. But I think the best advice is to pick one between the pair of you and stick with it for a while, at least.
Definitely. I mean, that's how we did it. But back when I first started playing, I didn't quite actually realise the two games were playable together. It wasn't until I started playing with Tim down the club and he brought out his circle that I realised. I was like, oh, okay.
It's like, and now you're getting a spanking by the circle. Oh, good.
Lovely. Indeed.
I think I probably might say, Alex, that War Machine is a little bit simpler to learn. But I think it's marginal.
Yeah. It's not massive. I mean, obviously, you don't want to kind of get into one game that you don't like the aesthetic of, or you don't particularly like any of the factions in just for the sake of playing it. But, you know, maybe if you don't like the aesthetic of it, maybe just to start learning the game, is if you've got someone there who's got some War Machine stuff, buy their stuff and just, you know, play a few games and get the hang of it from that way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can see what you're saying. Either way, it's important to learn at the start things like the basics of power attacks and the control area. So as long as you've got a sort of firm grounding there, then you're ready to maybe move on a bit, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
So, but that's kind of... Yeah, that really just tie back to the whole thing of don't go too big too early. Because I've seen players who did jump pretty much straight in at 50 points and their heads explode. It really is quite frightening to watch, because, yeah, you've got your battle group there and that's activating, but then you've got units and they activate all at the same time. And it starts to get onto one of my sort of little topics, which is learning how order of activations can really affect what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because you can either make things a lot easier for yourself, or end up blocking yourself in horribly and creating
the amount of times I've seen problems. People start activating stuff and just move it and then move on to the next unit and you say, "Whoa, stop!" And they actually forget they're playing a sort of a full.
There are a lot of other games out there where you move. We have a movement phase where you move everything, and then an action phase where you action, then maybe combat phase where you combat. It's very different.
Just getting your head around that can be quite difficult sometimes, and just kind of focusing on like you say, order of activation, and making sure you're aware of what you're doing before you do it. You're not just kind of moving stuff off. Like in certain other games, I will do this combat over here first of all. You know, it's not that incidental. Just get it out of the way. Move on to you have to really think about what you're doing and where you're doing it and why you're doing it.
So otherwise, you end up at the end of the turn with sort of one lot of your army over here, one lot over there, and your caster standing there in the middle, going, "Oh, this has all gone a bit pear shaped. There is nothing in front of me, and I have no focus. This is going to hurt." Or you end up with an almighty blocking of line of sight. See also people who have boom howlers at the front and do some very creative destruction of their own turn with how they place those. It's like, "Oh, I'll run boom howlers up all in a line, and now
swear a lot.
Nothing of my army can see anything. Oh, this may have been a mistake."
Yeah. So. And that's a thing to remember as well. It's kind of, you know, in this game, friendly and enemy stuff does block line of sight. You know, irrespective, you know, you can kill your enemy stuff, your own stuff, sorry, there's no penalties for doing that, you know, things like that. They may seem gamey to start with, but they are part of the game, and it is designed that way, you know.
Well, the line of sight rules are some of the most important things to learn in War Machine, I think.
Yeah.
Because the enemy people, even to this point of War Machine, they've been playing for a couple of years, will occasionally go, "Well, I've got a bigger base, so I can see you."
Oh, God, don't even start
that is
one.
Not how it works.
There we go. Then somebody will hit you in the head with a rule book.
Well, quite. No, the line of sight rules are hideously important.
Oh, I'm really glad I've got another regiment brush, because I've just ruined one. Sorry.
See, I keep occasionally buying new ones, ruining regiment brushes, and then going back to the original one, which is only sort of half ruined.
No, ruined as in I tried to touch up paint job where I glued and just got super glue all over it.
Okay.
No, that's straight in the bin.
Yeah. Oh,
but
see,
I've got one more. I've actually got two more brand new ones. Good.
That'd be dry brush time for me. Anyway.
It might be.
Very, very dry brush.
Yes, exactly. You get some interesting effects off that.
Sorry, did I really derail the conversation? That never happens.
No, never at all. Yes, we were on the line of sight rules.
Sorry. No, not really.
Well, no, because the line of sight rules, for being so important, are incredibly simple, really.
Really?
Set where you get into things like hills.
Not really. Not really difficult.
Well, so... But, well, you can't see over larger bases, essentially. There's nuance to it. It's not like true line of sight where you have to crane your neck over the table and go, a micron of my head pokes around this wall and can see your leg.
And you need to remember as well that models have a set volume above their base as well, which is kind of important for looking over hills and over buildings and things like that, because some models will be able to be seen over buildings, others...
Said how simple it was, and then you said seeing over hills.
Yeah, the volume thing, it has always been one of my greatest contentions with War Machine, because it's such almost a red herring at points, because people go... Well, that's got a larger volume than this, so clearly I can see it over all these things. It's like, it doesn't quite work like that. It goes on base size first, then there's other things in between. There's the whole thing about being able to draw a line from your volume to someone else's volume that just makes people's minds break. I don't know why.
The thing to remember is that if any part of your base edge can go to any part of another model's base edge, you know, without being blocked by a larger base than the target, or, you know, an obstruction terrain feature like a forest or something like that, then you can draw a line of sight. Now, that's not necessarily the distance you're going to have to shoot, because you measure the closest points between one another as well. That's another thing to kind of remember. You are measuring closest point to closest point on the bases. and you know, that kind of line of sight and where you measure from is sometimes can be misinterpreted, and you know, you say, oh well, I can't see closest point to closest point. Doesn't matter, that's only how far you measure.
I think you very interestingly mentioned something else there as well. Terrain yeah. is...
I mean, just before we move on, okay, to something else in relation to line of sight range and things like that, model placement is so important in this game, as just in general.
Are you saying if you leave them in your case, then it's not very useful?
Pretty much. But no, where you place a model is important, which way they're facing is important. You know, there are abilities in the game that knock models down. You know, you don't put the model down. Because no. that yeah. affects where the model is. So it's, I mean, these are all things, I mean, there's probably people out there listening to this who are thinking, yeah, all this. But it's so important if you are starting it.
I've actually seen people at clubs who, when something says the model is knocked down, will put the model flat on his back.
Yeah.
It's like some small part of me inside just goes, oh no, stop doing that. That's wrong.
I have to be honest, put my hand up and say, when I first started playing it in Mark 1, I did that.
Yeah.
I think in Mark 1, because you'd got things like you could stand up with any face.
Well, yeah, when you stood up, you could choose any facing.
It was... almost less important, but with the clarifications and furthermore with the reboot to Mark II, a lot of that stuff's changed and it's now become very set in stone. You don't put the model on its back.
No, you have you a leave token that says knockdown.
Exactly. Tokens, again, your friend.
Oh, tokens. Yeah, very good. Tokens essential. I mean, bottle tops that you painted look very nice, but actually I just really like the PP tokens. Be able to write on the relevant spells and things like that. You don't need 26 sets of them. And
as long as you make it clear to your opponent with your tokens what's going on, what upkeeps are where, and you know what effects are on the table, who's knocked down, who's stationary, things like that, then it's fine. It's when you start going, okay, I'm going to put a die down, and because that's set to a 1, that means this model's knocked down. No. Don't do it.
I've rolled the dice now. What was that one?
Yeah, especially if you've got like, okay, that's a 1, so that model's stationary, and that's a 2, so that means it's got 2 fury on it, and the number of dice by my caster is how many focus it's got. It's like, just stop. Take a step back and see how ridiculous you're making this. Admittedly, you know, 2 grown men playing with tin soldiers, already ridiculous. But still... There are limits.
Just flip the table. It's fine.
I do have to say, I've yet to see anyone do a proper table flip.
I
other than Kurt.
not just seen it, though, have you? I would quite like to see it.
I have seen it.
Because you did it.
I've seen my models hit the floor.
No, he didn't do it.
I didn't do it.
He's victim to the table flip.
I hit the guy in the head with the rule book and he flipped the table over.
Like you do.
Yeah, and then he married
Lesson
my sister.
Three.
After that, he then married my
War
sister.
Machine in the first 6 months. Try not to take it too seriously.
Yes.
Page 5 is not a reason to be a dick.
Yeah.
Don't get drunk. Don't get drunk and play Kurt till 2 in the morning.
Yeah. That is something that to take into consideration. At page 5, you know, it is... It's kind of on the way now a little bit. It's not in every single book you produce.
Well, but page 5 is very much to be taken... tongue-in-cheek, I think.
Well, not even that. I mean, the more recent page 5s, if you look at them, they are about saying that don't hide behind the fact that you had a, you know, a weaker faction, or that, you know, your opponent had all the good stuff and you didn't have anything good. It's basically saying bring your A game to every game, play like you want it, and just be competitive. And it's not about kind of whinging and whining about how he had more stuff than you or this, that, and the other.
I got diced.
Yeah, I got diced, yeah. Don't, you know, just come back and come back stronger and with a, you know, more resolve to beat that person next time.
To be fair, I think just for the people who may have skipped over page 5, because it's in the fluff section of the book, pretty much, but there are 5 rules on page 5 in the prime rule book.
3 rules, aren't there?
No, it's 5. Number 1, thou shalt not whine.
Oh.
Number 2, come heavy or don't come at all. Number 3, give as good as you get. Number 4, win graciously and lose valiantly. And number 5, page 5 is not an excuse. And it's basically saying, you know, bring your A game, aim to have fun, and, you know, don't use this as a way to say, well, you know...
Or to bully
other
players. That's really where it came from. It's not that it was there were... I've been in shops where kids have been really acting like complete tools with each other. because like, oh, this isn't page five, you can go shut up or go home, blah blah blah, and it's the person winning very ungraciously.
Yeah.
It usually. He's just saying telling the other person what a douche they are because they were losing. And you're like, no, that's not what it's about.
Both players need to remember that they're both there to have a fun game.
Yeah. Game is a good word there.
Yeah.
All very true.
I think, you know, admittedly you said that page five is being sort of almost phased out a little, but it is still there, and I think the kind of the message behind it still is valid.
Yeah, definitely.
It's just that maybe there are some people who take what is said on page five a little too seriously.
Yes, and a little too literally.
Just a smidge.
Nick.
But coming back onto what you were going to say about terrain, sorry.
Yes, terrain is your friend. Do not be scared of it. Use a variety of it and learn the rules for it.
I would say to your friend, unless playing Signal.
Nah, that's true, friend. How many people can you honestly say you know who play War Machine who know the rules for water?
Shallow or deep water?
Knocking down jacks in water both. And it was rough terrain and...
Oh, no, both and knowing the differences between the two.
Oh, nothing can enter deep water unless it's got amphibious.
Or can it?
Voluntarily.
Yeah, there are some weird rules. Deep water is one you very rarely see on tables. On the room.
Deep water you can't voluntarily enter unless you've got the rules to allow it, haven't you?
I believe that was a Mark 1 rule.
Oh, fuck, really?
Yeah, you can enter deep water now, I believe, but you also...
You just if you do it with a warjack, you've just lost it.
You screwed yourself going into deep water. You never enter deep water.
Can enter deep water, but you just drown.
Pretty much.
You don't take a swim check.
Yeah, deep water is something that you don't... You really, really don't...
Shallow water is basically rough terrain.
I mean, the very first time I saw War Machine played competitively was right after my demo game, and there was a table that somebody was playing on that was entirely swamp, and I've never seen that done since. Half movement across the entire table. Yes, please.
Do not want. Just do not want.
Do not want to put warjacks on it.
I believe the Menoth player playing had Vindictus. So he didn't care.
Oh, because of his... Trooper. Yeah.
Trooper's on the infantry.
Yeah, so he didn't care.
Yeah, but Vinny's going to play...
Vinny can't give a Pathfinder to Jax. So, oh, because he wasn't playing many Jax, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Trooper is only infantry. It's only warrior models.
But like I said, Vinny plays lots of infantry, so it's fine.
Yeah. My Vinny list's got three heavies in it. I'm sorry what I was thinking.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
To be fair, Reckoners don't need to move very far, so, you know.
Do you want the rules on deep water?
Yeah.
A warjack in deep water is removed from play. A model cannot begin a charge or run while in deep water. As long as any part of its base is in deep water, a model moves only half an inch for every 1 inch of its movement and cannot make actions, cast spells, use feats, or give orders. A model in deep water cannot engage other models or make attacks. A warcaster in deep water can still allocate focus points and use them to maintain upkeep spells. A model in deep water has a base defense of 7. A warrior model ending its activation in deep water automatically suffers 1 damage point.
Wow. So,
war beast can go into it and... Aside from obviously not being able to do much while they're in it, you don't really take much contact.
Exactly. You can go in deep water if you want to. You just screw yourself badly.
Yeah.
Well, it depends how wide the deep water is. You know, if it's only an inch or two wide, you know, if it's like
But if you end your activation within deep water. Hang on, does it just say warjack ending its activation within deep water?
No, a warjack in deep water is removed from play. So even if you, essentially, you're touching
water. So if a colossal base touched the deep water, you'd remove the colossal from play.
Remove it from play. But only
this seems like a bad idea.
Oh my god, I need tiny pinpricks of deep water to put on tables.
Only warrior models.
Is that storm? Is that storm wall in that deep water? Remove it from play.
Again, this seems like a bad idea. I don't like this. We're abandoning this idea immediately.
Mike, can we play deep water tomorrow?
No.
Another thing, here's another question for you. Shallow water. If a warjack that is knocked down is moved into shallow water for one reason or another, is it removed from play?
No, it has to be down in the water.
Or is it... Yeah. So, if a model is knocked down in shallow water, is it removed from play?
No, it goes inert.
Nope.
Is it not going inert anymore?
Nope. It is stationary until its furnace is restarted.
Yeah.
Which means a Warcaster has to spend entire activation in base-to-base to restart it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
No, not a Warcaster. A friendly warrior model in base-to-base contact with a Warjack can restart it by forfeiting its
activation. We need to read the rulebook more often.
The Warjack must forfeit its activation and cannot channel spells the turn it is restarted.
Wow. That's nowhere near as lethal as
I think what you were thinking was when a Warjack goes inert because its battle group is destroyed. Like, if you kill Junior and he's got jacks, I think then the Warcaster has to spend the turn in base.
But if it's there, I'm like, what?
It goes on to say here, even if a Warcaster, other than its controller, restarts it, the Warjack remains part of its original battle group. When a Warjack's furnace is restarted, the Warjack automatically stands up.
Cool.
Sweet.
The more you know.
There we go.
The more you know.
But this is probably part of a good reason why you should be, you know, using terrain and getting used to its rules.
What you should do at the end of your 6 weeks, 6 weeks, 6 months of playing, whatever, your first 6 months, you should go back and you should read the rule book again.
So should we.
And then you should probably read the rule book again every 6 or so months, just to make sure it's in your brain. But none of us do, as you can tell.
Yeah.
That's why we all get caught out at tournaments and do badly.
And there's the occasional rule that seems to creep in from Mark 1 every so often.
Oh, I do that a lot.
Someone mentions it in passing. It's like,
even
really?
If you never played Mark 1, you pick up Mark 1 rules.
It's like with the with throws, you know, if a model that's thrown hits a model with a larger base, it doesn't
should we be issuing a correction for last week's the last episode rather? Where smaller-based models hitting larger ones when they've been thrown.
What did we say? I've forgotten.
So have I.
Basically, it was...
if a small-based model hits a large-based model, it takes extra dice damage, but the large-based model doesn't take any damage.
Yeah. The thing was, last week, last episode, we were discussing a game I had against a certain player using Mountain King. Knocking down my blood trackers and throwing them at my warp walls.
I assumed you meant the cavalry ones.
Yeah, it would work with the cavalry ones, but
that's what I thought you meant. Sorry, that's why I assumed you must mean that because of large bases.
Yeah, no, I didn't.
Oh,
but yeah, it just shows you know, an experience, and you know, and, it's difficult because I think you say read the rulebook over again, but you start reading the rulebook and you think, I know all this, you know, I know how to build my army. And
played,
you know,
this game 20 years.
Well, that's it, precisely. But it is those little nuances, and maybe it's not necessarily reading all the rule books. It's maybe sort of saying to yourself, right, I'm going to have a game, we're going to agree that we're going to use deep water, we're going to try and use as many special attacks as we can do, you know, try and use these obscure rules that, you know, you don't always use and don't always come up against.
It often tends to be little things, like people not realizing that slams, unless otherwise stated on the model, have to be directly towards.
Yep.
So I've seen people trying to do slams at the edge of bases. It's like, no, you turn to face first and then just go in straight. Like, oh, really? Do I have to do that? Yes. Or bizarre ruling, bizarre stuff with throws. That actually is probably the section of the rulebook that gets called the most often at tournaments. People going, I want to make a double-handed throw here. How do I do that again?
Oh, my God.
Or the simple fact that if you want to push one of your own models, that you don't have to actually hit it.
Nope.
If you want to push any model, you don't actually have to hit it.
Nope.
You're just making a post-strength test.
I thought you'd still got a hit.
Nope.
Nope. Push.
Push is not able to hit.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough. See, you learn something new every day.
There you go. So it's well worth kind of using them. I mean, can you honestly tell me without looking at the rule book how a headlock or weapon lock works?
Well, hang on. They're quite different for Hordes and War Machine, though, aren't they?
No, they're the same.
They're not.
They are.
They're worded very differently because you can't lock a weapon in Hordes.
You can.
No, you don't. There isn't. There's no weapon to lock.
I believe your weapons are still listed as
your weapons are still listed left, right, head.
A model making a headlock stroke weapon lock can lock a warjack or warbeast weapon or head and prevent its use. A warjack must have at least one non-crippled open fist to make a headlock stroke weapon lock a power attack. Declare what the attacking model is attempting to lock before making the attack roll.
So I think you're right one, don't I?
Probably.
See, this is all part. I think we should all be demoted back to our first 6 months, if I'm honest.
But no, you need. I think, you know.
Are you reading from the? Are you reading from the War Machine book, Alex?
I am reading from the War Machine book at the moment.
Because I'm just looking at the Hordes one, and you're right. What you just said verbatim is in the Hordes book. They're the same. I'm sure they were different in Mark One, but that doesn't make any difference now.
Yeah, no. Everything in Mark Two on the cards, it's still marked as left and right and things, which is why I noticed this back when I was looking at converting a Mulg with an Extreme One. You actually end up with a weapon in the wrong hand.
That's not good.
So technically, it's not
that legal. That is against the conversion rules anyway. Because if you swap them, if you're making conversions, the weapons have to be in the same hands.
Exactly. Hence why it becomes illegal.
Yes. The amount of people I've seen with Kador battle boxes with the wrong axes stuck onto the wrong model.
Or more frequently these
days. To be fair, they don't come with instructions.
No, they don't. But there's a picture on the front of the book, and that's another good point from the first 6 months. Again, what is on the model is important, and it kind of seems to start with that. That's going to put you off converting stuff, and it kind of does to a degree, but that's not the intention of it. It is because it is precise, and you know, it's same with the placement. You know, everything has its place, and it.
War Machine has always been held up as a very what you see is what you get system.
Yeah.
So if you look at the table, you know exactly, well, at a glance, what your opponent has. There's no sort of secret stuff or bits you can't see or, you know, surprising models that just happen to have a flamethrower. And if you look at it, you go, oh, right, well, those two have got flamethrowers and that one's obviously the UA. And it's easy to see in just a look,
yeah.
Although, you know, better if the army's painted, but...
Staying on power attacks. Can a model headbutt a model with a larger base in it?
No.
You can, but it doesn't knock it down.
No, it can't. You can't headbutt larger bases.
No, a model cannot headbutt while it's in a headlock. While held in a headlock, a model cannot headbutt a model with a larger base.
Wow.
There you go.
That's the whole thing on, what was it, medium bases can't trample as well.
Yeah, heavies.
They can now.
One specific one with a rule, with a rule that specifically says it can trample. Yes.
One can.
I think that's a key thing with the rules as well. Where a card says something different to the main rule book, the card wins, generally.
And automatically does, trumps automatically doesn't.
Yeah. So. Kurt's now thinking of the. Either looking at the rule book or trying to think of.
I'm thinking of what auto hit range weapons are there in stealth. Stealth is. I know in theory that's correct, but there are situations where you kind of go, no. Yeah,
you're trying to think of things like Veils, Oraculus, and
yeah, that's again, it's, yeah,
because that's range 8 and that can hit stealth.
Can it?
Well, it auto hits.
It auto hits.
Oh, okay, so it does trump stealth.
Right. Yeah. Well, stealth is auto miss, and
yeah.
The Oraculus is auto.
I was thinking. I was wondering if that I knew that ruling was in there, but there's always exceptions to things, aren't there?
Yeah.
It's very much dependent on how it's worded.
Mm.
Actually, I think that brings us on to a good point, really. Read the cards. Then when you've read them again. Then potentially read them again. Because...
It will be a test.
Yeah. Every game. It is really important that you know, or at least have a sort of a decent idea before you pick a card up, what the vague wording on a rule is. Because War Machine is very precise in its language. You know, there is a difference. There's a difference between things like healing and removing damage.
Yes.
For a start. So, you know, it's little differences in wording can make a big difference, and knowing what's on your card.
I would also, it's kind of the next step rather than one of the first steps, but knowing, it's true of any kind of game, know your enemy. But War Machine, where so many rules, yes, they've unified rules compared to the way it used to be, and a lot of things carry the same rules, but there are so many rules anyway. Knowing your enemy, knowing what if you're playing against a player that you play a lot of the time, it can be really useful to, if you've got War Room, invest in their deck and read their deck and know their stuff. Because your own strategy can be screwed right over if you suddenly go, what do you mean they're def 16? I thought they're def 12. Suddenly you can't hit them for diddly.
Yeah.
Knowing the stats, knowing... That's just more of a second stage thing, though, because that's hard to do when straight out of the gate. But
yeah. Well, that's the thing. You know, almost for my first year, I was kind of having to check back to cards a lot and see what things were. Now, after about sort of 2 years of Kador... sort of all told, I can almost play entire games without referencing the cards because I've just played the same stuff so often. It's like, yeah, I know what that is. That's def 12. That's def 11.
Find yourself telling the opponent what their own stats are. That's what
that one is when it gets worrying. It's like, what's the def of that?
I'll tend to wait these days. I'll be like, they are def 12, aren't they? They are this. They are that.
Yeah. So, but it is... It's one of those little things. But as you said, that's more of a sort of, okay, I've learned how the game works. Now let's learn what's in it.
Yeah.
So, but it does help with reading the cards for things like stuff that doesn't come up too often, like crit effects. Because a lot of people forget things like crit smite, crit pitch.
Some people forget crit pitch is a throw in a direction, not at a model.
Well, it's single-handed. It's effectively a single-handed throw, isn't it?
It is, but it gets used for targeting if you're not careful. People do try and target off the back of it, they get it wrong, and they're like, oh, I just target this model.
One thing to kind of cover off at this point as well is in relation to kind of knowing what stuff does and things like that. Don't expect to be able to go online, find a list, and expect to win.
Yes.
There are certain lists that will help you do that and will be easier to win with. But I don't think there are any lists out there that are auto-win by anyone, you know, unlike maybe some games that are out there that are...
And also, every list, even if you have got to the point where this is one Masters, every list has its foil, every caster has their foil in this game.
Pyatrol in the case of Lilith 2. Pyatrol in the case of Lilith 2.
Yeah. The greatest thing you can always do with list building is put something on the table. And actually go, okay, let's play a couple of games with this. Oh, that's not quite working. Okay, what if I change this model to another one? That's working a little bit better. Maybe if I just change how I'm using it. Maybe if I change another model. And you build up your own style.
We're not talking mid-game here, though. Don't do this mid-game.
No, no.
That might piss your opponent off slightly.
Well, yes.
I mean, very much in this, if you net deck a list... You will play it completely different to the person who won the tournament with it, because playstyle is a big thing in this. It's not like card games, which is where net decking mostly comes from, where there is one way to play that deck.
Well, I think
that's all he had to say about that.
He's just like, well, I'm talking and now I'm going to mute you.
I won't just put stuff in my mouth.
Oh, hey, that's more than we need to know.
So while when Nick does the Brian,
when did Kev join the show again?
But no, I was hungry.
Oh, well, there we go.
Oh, that's what you call it.
Is that what he said? Yeah.
Low calories.
I think there's something to be said for the fact that you can almost differentiate lists by who originally created them. It's like, well, this list contains these 6 points, and this list contains these extra 4 points over here that make a difference.
You can get an extra 10 points.
You know what I mean. It's like some people will go, oh, well, I'm playing this list, so obviously the War Dog is automatically included.
Obviously.
But someone else will go, well, I'm playing this list, so I'll definitely have Silas Wishnailer in there. Or this list has these models, so I will need Iana and Holt as backup. Whereas someone else goes, well, I'll have a squad of Widowmakers. It's just, it's those little personal preferences that, you know, revolve around your playstyle.
Yeah,
it's like,
and again, I mean, talking about playstyle as well, and particularly Iron and Hulk, things like that, is kind of, you know, decide for yourself whether you're building a list to kind of to beat a specific opponent, you know, that's going to have limitations on the list, or are you kind of designing a list to go against all comers, or are you going to design lists, you know, for, you know, will be good against certain things. One list you maybe take against Crits, one list you maybe take against, you know, Menoth and Legion, another list you take against...
Well, I think that's part of the process of list experimentation.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's, yeah, like, I mean, like you were saying before, with kind of swapping models out, is experiment, and, you know, speak to Kev Bryant, he knows about that, so...
He's ignoring that comment entirely.
Experimentation is good.
You will go on forums and see people going, well, clearly this model is terrible. You should never play it in any army, and anyone who does is clearly an idiot. And then you might put it on the table and think, well, actually, I've got a use for this.
Yeah.
And I think I can do something different to what people are saying you might do with it.
Yeah.
And I mean, just look at the amount of models and units that were originally kind of junked off when they first came out that have come back into vogue, and like you say, maybe people have started using them in different ways, and, you know, using stuff in a different way to how it's normally received is going to be a way to maybe wrong foot more experienced players. I mean, there's going to be certain players out there who will have seen a lot of it, know a lot of it, and maybe come up with a lot of it themselves. But, you know, it's
I always think the best thing. For the game or a tournament or whatever, is to turn up to a table against someone who's played the game a fair bit, sit down, start putting your list out, and for them at the start of the game to go, right, so what does your caster do again? I just have that moment of, oh, this'll be fun.
It's when they say this is a really bad matchup for me. That's something you need to worry about.
That's another 2 quid.
That's to be wary of that when it's a very seasoned player.
Yeah.
Wary of the whole kind of, yes, this is bad, I just don't stand a chance here. This is, especially when it's a fairly good seasoned player, especially if they're called Pat Vance or Jamie Perkins.
I think a
rotund Asian character from a Disney film.
I think at the higher tables, there's always a certain amount of mind games going on, and yeah, it happens.
I wouldn't know. No, me neither.
I get to see them. Occasionally get to see them, and then you go, oh, I've just slipped back down again.
Well, if you're on the sort of the lower tables, you generally tend to get a better line of sight to them, so...
Yeah, mid-table obscurity seems to be my destiny for quite a while.
Once you're 4 rows away, you kind of get a good view of the top tables from a distance. So, yeah.
But I think the most important thing for the first 6 months of playing War Machine is just have fun.
Yeah, have fun, play games, and, you know...
Don't take the losses too hard.
Try not to take it too seriously.
Don't do a top-em.
Yeah, just don't do that.
No power gaming. Well...
Don't rage quit factions every 10 seconds.
Technically, does power gaming exist in War Machine?
Yeah. Everything does.
Every faction's got completely broken stuff in. Oh, well, from the point of view of other factions. So, it's an interesting discussion, I think.
But, in some regard, whole factions are broken, don't they?
Well, yes. It's an interesting discussion, which I think we can probably hold off for another time. So, I think at this point, maybe if we go for a break... Yes.
Right time.
Sounding good. Okay, well, we'll go for a break and we'll see you all on the other side. Are you looking for affordable terrain for your tabletop and your bases? Then try Terrain Geek. They have a growing range of hobby supplies, including Army Painter and Cote d'Armes paints. All this and more is available at www.terraingeek.com. They are also contactable on Twitter at @terraingeek. Are you in the UK? Do you want to know when the latest War Machine and Hordes events are? Visit bit.ly/UK War Machine events for the most up-to-date calendar. Submit your own events to the calendar by emailing ukwarmachineandhordesevents@gmail.com. Right, well, welcome back. Hope you enjoyed the break and the many messages therein.
It was a longer break than usual, wasn't it?
I don't know. The film chat was good.
I might actually include part of what we talked about during the break as part of the outtakes. I don't know yet.
Hey, a bonus material. Nick's not in any of it.
But don't you ask me, we could actually have a bonus episode with what was in that break, to be honest.
And Nick wouldn't be in any of it.
Well, yeah, it's quite. We have the Spelling It Out section now, where this week we're looking at Horlock Doomshaper, Shaman of the Gnarls, or P. Doomshaper, if you're keeping score on that front.
Horlock 1.
Yeah, if you want to call him that, it's fine. There's only one person I know who uses the 1-2-3 format, but there we go.
We all use the 3s for certain casters, don't we?
Yes, true. I feel I should hand over to your expertise here, Kurt, for the...
Oh, am I the expert troll player, am I?
You're the expert at reading spell lists.
I am. I can... But I'm trying to paint. Right. You'll make a mess of it.
No, I'm not Nick.
You could do it if you like, because I prefer you doing it and me heckling you than me doing it and you heckling me.
Shall I say what they are and then you can actually talk about them with some knowledge because you two have actually played trolls? So, the first spell is Banishing Ward. It costs 2, it's range 6, it's no AoE, no power, it's upkeep model, it's not offensive. Enemy upkeep spells on target friendly model, stroke units expire, affected models cannot be targeted by enemy spells or animi.
It's very handy.
Yeah, just a bit.
Very handy, especially against them, they're cricks.
Yeah.
Well, I can imagine that being very useful for your sort of... your frontline unit, your Fenblades or your Creel Warriors or something like that, that's moving up first and just to stop anything sticking on them from the get-go.
Stop you getting crippling grasped.
Yeah. So that it's a tool to kind of almost determine where that clash happens.
Excuse Alex. Yes.
Yes, quite.
Just stop you getting bogged down and dissuaded by spells and stuff. Yeah, yeah. Very useful.
I suspect as well, it's quite decent in the late game for...
put it on your caster.
For targeted upkeep removal. Because obviously you just have more of a wide-ranging nuclear option, but I think we'll move on to that one a bit later. There's not too much you can say about it, really, other than... trolls quite like having a way to get rid of enemy upkeeps.
Yeah, it's good for getting rid of upkeep spells.
Yeah.
That's all that really can be said.
Yeah.
Oh, it stops you getting things cast in as well, which is what we just said. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good.
It's the can't be targeted. Although, again, there are ways around that with things like sprays and AoEs and...
Sprays don't tend to leave crippling grass behind, though. That's the...
Yeah. True. Okay. Well, should we move on to the next one?
As he's not talking, the next one is 14, as Alex has gone silent with some kind of coughing fit.
Sorry, no, I am back. Sorry, go on, 14.
Are you back for good?
Don't, just back shush. No, no.
You knew where I was going with that, didn't you?
God, I hate
whatever
you.
I said. Whatever I did. I didn't mean it.
Formally, I really have never been able to stand and take that. I even cinema could take that, and I still can't stand and take that, alright?
So funny it hurts.
Alex, I'm going to have to give you a dead arm for that shit next time I see you. I might actually, that alone has convinced me that I really should try and come to Masters if I need to hit you.
I believe that hitting a judge might be...
How about in front of your children?
Yeah, hitting a judge might be tantamount to getting yourself kicked out.
Hitting, sorry?
A judge.
Who's a judge?
Me's a judge.
Yeah.
Who's a
judge? Yeah, but not in the event.
For Masters, National Masters.
I was going to hit you at the event.
What?
I was going to hit you in your house in front of your own children.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that works as well.
Yeah, entirely different. I get DQ'd from almost everything I go to these days.
Should we move on to Fortune, then?
Fortune. Yeah. Alex, you going to do this bit?
Yeah, I can do. It costs 2, range 6. Non-AOE, no power, it is upkeep, but it's not offensive. Wonder why we've heard that stat line before.
The last spell?
Banishing Ward, yes. Target-friendly faction model or unit can re-roll its missed attack rolls. Each attack roll can be re-rolled only once as a result of Fortune.
It's great.
Not as good as Morvana's ability.
No.
Well, no, he's not having to pay life for it for a start.
That's true.
Yeah, it's just an all-round good spell. And you will notice it says just missed attack rolls. Not missed melee attack rolls or missed ranged attack rolls. It's all of them.
Or missed magic attack rolls.
Yes, quite.
Because I find it's... with Doomshapers, I can't help but compare 1 to 2. And I always think... Because I've played 2 a lot more before I played 1. And I immediately see Fortune and think, ah, it's like Wild Aggression, but actually you can put it on anything. Wild Aggression is boosted attack damage, melee attack rolls, but on War Beasts, but actually this can be put on a unit and it's a reroll and an extra dice. Not quite the same, but similar.
I think it's good in that it is very flexible. It's model unit, which is a good start. And it does work with pretty much anything. Unless something is a pure support piece, you're probably going to get some kind of benefit out of Fortune being out there.
It works very well with the three-man units that we'll come on to in a bit.
Not quite.
Bastards. Are you ready for Purification?
Yes.
Purification is the next spell. Cost 3, range shelf, AoE control, no power, it's not occupable, and it's not offensive. And it is, as everybody knows, continuous effects, animite, and upkeep spells in this model's control area immediately expire.
With a 14-inch control area as well.
Yes, it's rather nice.
It is rather nice.
To be fair, with Purification and Fortune, that's largely the kind of spell list I don't want to see when I'm playing Kador.
Yeah.
It's like, I have the Winter Guard Infantry. Like, great. They were F-17, then they're F-14.
Not anymore.
I'm going to throw a Fortune out as well. My Fen Blades are hitting now.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, Purification to me on that spell list is kind of counterintuitive to Banishing Ward.
Isn't it?
Yeah, Banishing Ward's very much the sort of the targeted version.
Yeah, obviously.
Because he's also got Fortunes and upkeep. It's like, and also being hordes, he's got animi to throw out there as well. It's like, do I really want to clear off everything, or would it be okay if I just cleared off this one thing over here? So the next one on the list is Rampager, if you want to go on that, Alex.
Yeah, sure thing. Repair the war room is designed to close itself down. So Rampager, it is cost 3, range 10, it's no AoE, no power, it's not keepable, it's not keepable, but it is offensive, sorry. It says take control of target enemy non-character war beast. That's war beast, not warjack. You can make one full advance with the war beast, and then can make one normal attack with it, then Rampager expires. While a war beast is affected by Rampager, it cannot be forced, and you cannot use its animus. Rampager can only be cast once per turn. And notice the attack as well. It just says attack. It doesn't say range. It doesn't say melee. It's just attack.
Yeah. I think the most important thing at the moment to take in with this spell is non-character.
Yes.
Because at the point where this came out, there wasn't so much of a proliferation of character war beasts.
They had kind of one each, isn't it, at the time?
Yeah.
Not even that. When this came out, Mark II, they had one each, yeah.
Yeah, you got Moloch, you'd got your Mulg, and it's like, okay, they're kind of there. Whereas now you're seeing Tiberian a lot for Scorn as well. And particularly seeing someone try to cast this on Tiberian at the Welsh Open. I walked up to the table and just they're going, oh no, I can't move Tiberian because it's outside of his activation. And I went, well, that's not the only thing. He's a character. You can't cast Rampager at him anyway.
Yep.
It's like, oh.
It's highly situational, in my experience. I have used it. I have done damage with it. It can be... The attack is the bonus as well, even then.
Yeah.
What can be really useful is take said strategically placed War Beast and move it out of the way to get line of sight to something else. Or just take a War Beast and go, you walk the wrong direction and face the wrong way. Stand in the corner.
It can be used for walking beasts out of control area. That's quite fun.
It can be used for that. I've never, yeah.
Walking them out of the control area and also getting them to face sort of friendly models.
If you're overexposed against him, he can then walk it past him. So it's gone past him, facing the wrong way. So, yeah, that's quite handy.
The other one is walking it towards your own war beasts. And if it's a bit situational for Doomshaper, where he'll be within 10 inches of a beast and can't get one of his beasts to charge it. That one's kind of...
You could use it a bit like TK to turn things around to drop his defense. Yeah,
exactly. And I think with his Fury stat, Fury 7, it's not that hard to stick either.
No.
So, it's a good versatile spell, but unfortunately, it only works against hordes. Because obviously it says War Beast.
Yeah.
And it obviously is non-character, which is getting more restrictive at the moment. Obviously, you do still see a lot of Ravagors, a lot of Earthborns, but you just need to watch what you're doing with it.
Yeah. I don't have anything to add to that, I don't think. It's it can be handy, but you can't really base an attack around it.
Yeah.
No. Should we move on to the last spell?
Go on, then. Why not?
She's Stranglehold, which is range 2. So it's
range 2?
It's cost 2. It's range 10. It doesn't have an AoE. It's power 11. It's non-upkeepable, but it is offensive. And the text on it reads, that a model damaged by Stranglehold forfeits either its movement or its action during its next activation as its controller chooses.
I think this is the token spell with a POW.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything else you really say about it.
I can't think I've ever used it. I mean, it has uses. It could go, if you can't get the damage off, then obviously you can cripple a beast. Oh, yeah, especially if a character or beast that's coming towards you, or that's in it, that may be strategic next turn.
Particularly if you've managed to knock it down somehow.
I'm going to say, if you really want to cripple something, if you manage to knock it down,
yeah,
you stick that on it. But then I suppose if it's a war beast, it can sacrifice, you know, it can shake off the knockdown and then only have to sacrifice one or the other.
So what could be really useful against would be gargantuans.
Power 11.
Shake it off.
Well, if you can't shake it off. You have to sacrifice movement or action. You can't shake it off.
You can't shake Stranglehold.
No.
No, it's really nice. Because you can't knock
power
it down.
Power 11's.
Armor 18, boosted. You've only got to do one damage.
You do have a point. However.
That's a really good spell against the Gargantuans. Less so Colossals because they've got a slightly higher armor, but.
Well, less so Colossals because most Colossals have a lot of guns, and
yeah.
If Doomshaper is within 10 inches.
Oh, I can't move.
Well, no, you can't move. Oh, I can't move. That's a shame. I'll use my two defender cannons and my chain guns.
All right. It's better against Hordes, which is where I started. But it's just poignant. It's gained power. The bigger these nicely big things that you can't knock down, you can't freeze, suddenly go, you have to sacrifice move reaction. That's actually not a bad way of giving them a bad day.
Especially if you park things just outside the threat range.
Mm.
Well, just outside the reach range, rather. So it's like, I can move forwards, but then I can't hit you. If I stand where I am, I can do nothing. That's actually an incredibly good point, Kurt.
Yeah. I've never actually fought Hornet Doomshaper against a Gargantuan or Colossal, but yeah.
Yeah. Other than that, it's the token damage spell, I think.
Yeah.
So, but
the power 11 is there to chip it into so you can actually do damage and slow something up a bit.
So, okay. Well, should we move on to his feet?
Why the heck not?
It's quite a nice feet, actually.
Yeah, it's very good. It's called Dunia's Wrath. Enemy models that suffer D6 damage point... Sorry, we'll start that again. It's called Dunia's Wrath, and the text reads that enemy models suffer D6 damage points for each focus or fury point they spend while in Doomshaper's control area. Enemy war beasts suffer D6 damage points for each fury point they receive as a result of being forced while in Doomshaper's control area. If a model is destroyed as a result of this damage while casting a spell or using an animus, the spell or animus does not take effect. If a model is destroyed as a result of this damage while making an attack, the target model suffers no further damage or effects from the attack. Dunia's Wrath lasts for one round.
Yeah.
Felt a little good.
Yeah.
It's a very effective controlling kind of early feat. It's where I tend to lean towards it.
Yeah. It's very much in the vein of next turn, you know the opposing player wants to cast Purification. It's like, okay, I'll just move up a bit and if you really want to cast Purification, you can. However, you'll be taking 3d6 of damage.
Yep.
Which is horrendous. I know there are some casters who will just sit there and go, can I afford to take 3 dice at this point? Because that's potentially up to 18 damage.
And you can take that.
You could stop some assassination runs absolutely cold with it as well. It's like, just put yourself in a what would otherwise be a potentially dangerous situation and watch someone like E. Kane go, I don't think I'll bother this turn.
But even then, I mean, Warjacks, because they're going to have 3 focus, they take less damage, but...
Warjacks don't take any.
Each focus...
Oh, sorry, no, enemy models... Yeah, because they spend it off them, don't they? Yeah.
They do. No, the allocation doesn't cost anything, but when they spend them. So whenever you're forced or whenever you spend focus on a Jack or a Warbeast, then they take damage, D6 damage each time. So that can be not insignificant, but obviously Warbeast has usually generally higher fury stats, so that's more damage potentially.
Yeah. Well, the thing is as well, you know, he's obviously the Warjack, well, I'd say it's probably the same for a Warbeast actually, as if he starts its activation out of the control area, let's say allocation doesn't hurt it, it can spend it to charge, and then once it gets there, you know, just make its initial attacks.
Yeah. Yeah, it can take the edge off for assassination, it can create a dead turn, or it can take a turn where they might kill trolls, but they're Warjack and Warbeasts are quite heavily dented when you have to do anything.
Well, it's almost like an extended version of spiny growth for Warbeasts and Warjacks. Because, you know, it's one of those things where the D3 from spiny growth will add up over time. D6, that's painful.
Mm.
So, especially for stuff like the warp wolves in circle.
Yeah.
That can vary. I mean, you only need to spend 2, and that's potentially one of the aspects gone. So, yeah, there's a lot. And the big one in there as well is, you've got people like Ran, who cast Force Hammer, and then go, oh, okay, didn't want to do that. 4d6 damage.
Yep.
You can really catch people out. It's a nasty, horrible
feat. It's nasty. It's timing, it's the trickiest bit I find with him. Getting the timing right is really difficult.
Well, he was one of those casters who at the start of Mark II is very much...
Maligned.
Partially because he's got fairly poor defensive stats.
Yes.
And, you know, he's one of those casters that, who as Mark II has gone on, people have gone, ooh, actually, no, I've got ways I can use this.
He's difficult. He's not, I mean, I've used him and tried him and played him, and he's difficult. He has won some big Masters events in the US. He's difficult to use that well. He's hard. He's a finesse caster.
Very often, though, if you can get a handle on those casters and warlocks who play differently or bring something else that's odd to a faction, that's when you can get in some real success. And I think having access to Banishing Ward and Purification and his feat, he does bring something different.
Just...
Yeah, and obviously he's still got access to Goad as well, which is on the epic version.
Yep, and of course there's a whole kind of his relationship with Molg is an interesting twist as well. If you've got Molg in there and anybody damages him, Molg walks towards them 4 or 6 inches depending, and then smacks him with a big tree. I've killed, well actually it was the other Horlock, but it's the same principle. I've killed Cromack like that. Cromack trying to assassinate my caster.
Yeah, very often you do end up with that race at the end. It's like, can you kill Doomshaper before Molg bashes in the back of your head?
Yep.
So, especially when Doomshaper's just sort of transferring off the damage he takes for the first few as well. It's like,
I mean, the other element of him from the finesse point of view and from the unusualist is P. Doomshaper's themeless. I know we don't usually go into it with spelling it out, but I think he's so specialist and so unusual.
It's such a major part of what's seen him being played.
I own it. I've played it. I've used it in tournaments. I've played it in tier tournaments. It's bizarre, and it's again, it's another one that's hard to make work. I have won with it. I haven't won events with it. I haven't won succinctly with it. Oh, I might have to get that out. Anyway, I just had a thought about what I could play. But you're difficult because you do, in his theme, you don't have, most of the normal units that you'd have, offensive units, are all gone. So no Fens, no Creels, no Champions, none of that. No Scouts, no offensive units. You can have the Cruelstone unit, lovely, and it's UA, and you can have Runeshapers.
They're fairly offensive.
Oh, and they're cheaper. By the way, as well. They're a point cheaper.
Yeah, so it takes them down to, is it 4?
No, it takes them down to 3.
Oh, that's... See? That's just unnecessary.
It's.
So, it's a point each for 8 wound, tough models.
5 wounds, with steady.
Oh, is it 5 wounds?
5 wounds with steady.
Yeah, still pretty good.
Armour 15.
Yeah, that's...
They're not exclusive to that. And
no Creelstone, or...?
You get a Creelstone. You get the Creelstone, and it's fully loaded at the start.
I was going to say, so they're not really armor 15, are they?
No, they're armor 17.
Yeah, there we go.
Because the bubble's huge. Because you have a fully tooled up, massive Creelstone unit with the UA that ends up starting with 5 Fury on it. Because for each Creelstone, each Runebearer unit, or this is without looking it up, each Runebearer unit or solo, you have a Fury on the Creelstone at the start.
Yeah.
I'm now going to look it up to make sure I'm not talking about my rear, but I'm pretty sure I'm right.
Us talking yes. Rubbish. It's
1 Fury point for each Runeshaper unit or solo in the army. Runeshaper is cheaper. You get extra walls put on the table and you get an extended deployment zone. So it's just. And of course you get obviously the Runeshaper solo to Nissa as well, because she's rubbish. It's a very interesting list. Again, it's a finesse list that I have enjoyed yet to master. When's this going out?
Pardon?
When's this going out?
Sometime before the end of the week.
Oh, in that case, I'll shut up. One thing I haven't announced previously is I have a new nickname, apparently. I've been going into St. Austell playing games. I have a new nickname in St. Austell.
Oh?
Yes, hardcore hips. I got called. I have been told to talk, asked to talk about it on the podcast.
Hardcore hips.
Hardcore hips. We're playing hardcore. I got very excited. I won hardcore with Menoth last time I went down there. And this time by winning games, I suppose, just went to the schedule. And, apparently I was, swinging my hips quite a lot as I got quite agitated and excited because I do get quite starey eyed when I play, especially large lists at hardcore. Try to get the turns done fast enough and get quite excited when things start to go rather well. Yes. Matt Beer was quite excited that we put it on the podcast.
So you're kind of the Michelle Jenicky of wargaming then. Well, if you don't know that reference, it will go straight over your head. I will send you a gif of it.
I don't know that reference. I feel better for not knowing it.
I'm actually going to take some time out just to send you the gif.
Oh, thank you. Just for effect.
Yeah, if I can find it. Good old BuzzFeed. There we go. That'll do. Just paste that to you.
I'm going to regret this. I know it already.
Yeah, you are.
Okay. Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, that's about right. I think Matt Beer would say that's exactly right.
See, and once more, the internet is enlightened. I'm sure you can put that in the show notes. Someone will enjoy it.
I'm enjoying it quite now. I mean, the same sentence is out of sequence.
We know her. We know her.
I do now.
Yes, the internet knows her very well. Okay. Well, I think with everything there having been said, it's probably time to move on to the painting table, sponsored by Terrain Geek.
Terrain Geek. Indeed.
Go and buy some trenches. They're lovely. Seriously.
From Terrain Geek.
Stop the podcast now. Go to the website. Or even leave the podcast playing while you go to the website. Buy some trenches. They're lovely.
That's terraingeek.com?
Yes. Run by the lovely Stuart. But we're going to wait until you come back, so, you know, just go there now.
Have you found it now? Got it? Yep.
Just make sure you haven't mistyped or anything. It's fine.
No, it's a U. Good.
What?
Nothing. What happened with the typing?
Yes. Anyway, thank you, table. Sadly, or otherwise, Nick has left us. But being as we start
but we're going to eat his minstrels.
Being as we start with Alex anyway. Alex, what's on your painting table?
At the moment, a lady shaking her hips.
I should never link that gif.
It's pretty, you can't print things out like that.
Yeah. It is. Real
animated GIF. What, so I have printed it. Like, no. Oh.
This text was blinking in Word. Why isn't it blinking when I print it out?
Yeah, precisely.
Blinking when it is.
I have been painting today some planets.
Some planets, you say?
Some planets, I say.
Is it
Battlefleet
Gothic?
No, not Battlefleet Gothic. A few guys at the... the club have picked up Firestorm Armada.
Spaceships.
Yeah, it's the same people who make Uncharted Seas and Dystopian Wars, Spartan Games.
It's the same game, so, you know.
It's the same game, just under different guys.
Look, people, look, Somerset is a simple county, and when they make games in Somerset, they just make them all the same. It just works.
Yeah, that's it. They say they're local to you, aren't they, Spartan Games?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, ship the mallet somewhere that way. Yeah.
I will say they do some lovely models. I just want them to tighten their rule sets up just a touch.
Yeah, I mean the way I view it is it's a bit of a distraction from other games. You know, not viewing it competitively. It's just a bit of a. I mean, I don't know, it might not last that long down at the club. There might be some players who kind of drop out of playing it after a little while, but just give it a go. And
to be honest, if you buy a starter box, which is about 20, 25 quid?
30.
And you play 5, 6 games. You've probably still kind of had your money's worth out of that box. Yeah. So, because...
Rules are available free online, so...
Oh, that's always a good start.
Yeah.
There's probably even a quick play sheet somewhere that makes more sense than the rule book.
I've yet to find that one.
I'm just saying that for Dystopian Wars there is. Okay, so you're just painting up a selection of planets, are you? Or?
I've got like a polystyrene ball, and I think the way that the planets work, I'm not entirely sure. From kind of quickly browsing the forums, a lot of people have said it's better and easier to cut your polystyrene circles in half and you know, just lay them flat on the table as opposed to trying to come up with some way of kind of putting them on a flight stand or whatever. So I've cut a circle in half.
Have you bought spheres? You know you can buy halves, don't you?
Yeah, I went to the art shop and the only ones they had were spheres. So
okay.
I've got a few of those. So I've cut one in half.
Look, at least you didn't just buy a block and start chiseling out spheres,
oh
okay?
Oh, God. Yes, right.
Well, I did look to see if the Agni block so I could make make some asteroids. Well, yeah, that's it. That's one thing you can use, just normal rocks or, you know.
But paint them. Don't just put rocks on. John Webb would hate that. You've got to paint them. They'll be out of scale otherwise.
Yep,
definitely. To be fair, if you are going to make some asteroids, a little bit of poly cement on that foam can do interesting things for rocky surfaces.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I did think of, I mean, I don't know how well it would work, is that expanding foam. I'd be concerned it would get too big too quick, but...
Pardon?
That could work. It's very round. It forms... If you don't have anything to... It forms... Like, you can make sort of really weird planetoidy things. That would work quite well, but it will form quite smooth domes quite quickly.
Yeah.
There is also a danger of making a sort of, you know, planet-sized turd.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's there.
That was a huge cat.
Some sort of massive space cat. Yes. Okay.
Sorry. Took a dump on my table. Good.
Yes.
Moving on.
Yes. Okay. Okay, Alex. We'll move swiftly on from you then. Kurt, Hello. What's on your painting table?
Right now, on my painting table, it is Hunter's Grimm.
Ooh.
Yeah, I've been I really have been lacking painting motivation, so whilst at the Welsh Open, alongside picking up Fast Spray for X-Wing, so I'm sure we'll do an X-Wing episode somewhere soon, obviously.
We'll just end up as a half-hour outtake somewhere, and I can feel it.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a sensible plan.
Especially with the Wave 3 ships that have just come out.
Oh, they look really nice. I want a B-Wing, please.
Not a massive fan of the one from one of the games, though.
B-Wing. Oh, the Expanded Universe shuttle thing. Yes.
Yeah.
No, the TIE Bomber and the B-Wings look awesome.
Yes.
Anyway, yes. We're not digressing now, digressing in a future episode.
Yes, exactly.
I'm painting Hunter's Grimm. I've had one game with him where I played them appallingly. I do like the fact that Scouts gain
Ambush? Yeah.
In his tier, so I'm trying to get two units of Scouts into all his lists. Because 12 Scouts ambushing is just great.
I must say...
12 Scouts is bad enough.
Speaking about the Welsh Open, that Extreme War Wolf unit suddenly still hasn't turned up.
Yeah, it's still sat here. I'm looking right at it. It's still sat here.
Alex, you can have it when you finish the Stalker.
You just... There's no kind of two-way to this kind of conversation. It's just... You're just going to send that. Yeah... It's not really helping it move more than an inch or two a year at present. Mr. Build me a free PC as well while you're at it.
No, why not?
I sense great bitterness.
So, Hunter's Grimm. Yeah,
I'll give you a quick handy.
I thought for a bit of a change, I'd paint my all of them with white skin.
A sort of albino kind of
That's
effect.
The word I was after. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's... I
thought
it'd be
fairly new, yeah. But it's not really been done before.
No, it's never been done before, especially with trolls.
Oh, dear.
So they're kind of base... I've got basic colours on them now. They look pretty, but I need to get more... some more depth and tone and things next stage. Might put a wash on the metalwork for a good bit.
What are these depth and tone things? Surely
you know when you slap paint all over a model?
Yeah.
And you put another colour on, and another colour in some other
bits. Whoa, are you suggesting multiple coats?
No, colours.
Oh, right, multiple colours.
Yeah, you use at least three colours on your models. I wasn't going to go beyond three. I've got three. That's a big one, like the red one, for example, that you've got on their coats. You might put a bit of a wash over it, and then you might shade it up. Now I have to admit I don't do shades. I do a wash to darken, and then I will highlight back up and blend and stuff on the way back up. I don't quite get to the point where certain persons, Mr. Smith, will just get on his high horse about me getting washes out, but I'm still going to do it.
No, I use washes when I paint.
It's just a Buxton then and gets really on his kind of, oh no, I can't do that. You've got to shade properly. I'm like, fuck off. Expletive what? Sorry.
There's something to be said for both shading and highlighting and washing.
There are.
They both provide.
I like washing and blending back up. Yeah. And so that's his lovely model. Grimm is really. And the two little pigs are really cool. They're so full of character. I hadn't really noticed. It's like a lot of these models, when you start painting them, you see so much more detail as you're running the brush over the model and picking out the details and finding more bits to go, oh, that's got to be a different colour. Damn.
I think that's always good with sort of the warlock and warlock unit parts, because they've got to be the kind of the highlights of your army. Exactly.
For those people that saw my initial base attempting for Grimm, I have shortened it. It was a bit high. Even I'm now going to admit that the base was a bit high. So I have shortened his base so he's not stood out on a rocket outcrop that's twice his own height. it is lower now, but it is still quite high. I like it being a bit high. So there's some basic effects will follow as well at some point.
Okay, that's cool.
Monkeys and waterfalls.
Doubt there'd be a monkey.
Waterfalls or so 2 years ago, Alex. Come on.
No, there might be a waterfall, because just the whole kind of... the whole kind of Matt Hart and his Jarl. I was thinking, yeah, quite like that effect. We'll do a waterfall going backwards, perhaps. I don't know.
So what you need is a waterfall with sort of broken ice starting to flow down it.
Maybe not, I don't know. Or fire. I might have to put fire on his base just for the hell of it, because I put fire all over my metal. Fire on Grim's base somewhere. Sculpted fire.
I was going to say, Jay Taylor did
campfire. Some... Campfire. The edge of a campfire on the edge of the knife. Done.
Jay Taylor did some very nice fire effects for his Menoth by...
He sculpted them out of that grey stuff.
Yeah, he sculpted the front arc markers for all his Menoth stuff and put them on the base as a fire effect, which is really well done.
And then he did. Then he didn't bring them to the Welsh Open for trials.
Then I think he still had to sell them off as well.
Did he?
Yeah.
Yeah, he sold them all.
He's going through a phase of selling everything. So if you're looking for a bargain, look for Jay the Grim on Twitter. I'm sure he'd love you to get in contact. For my own painting table, I decided to pick up one of my Malifaux models that's kind of sat there half-painted for a while, and picked up Kyrus, who's meant to be sort of very sort of bright red and orange and yellow and fire-based, and I thought, no, I'm going to sort of take a tip from... Last Airbender, and have sort of an advanced form of fire, which is lightning. So Kyrus was done in electric blues, and I'm really quite happy with it. So she's done it quite nicely, and it only took a day.
Really?
Yeah.
Quite impressive. Oh, because you're not working. Yeah.
Well, it was a weekend day anyway, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't get any of those either.
Oh, what with your actual responsibility for other people as well?
Yeah.
Madness.
Well, I have them all the time, so yeah.
Anyway, it being ridiculously late or early, depending on your viewpoint.
There's Australians in their viewpoints, so I don't know whether it should be allowed.
Yes.
It really depends what time people are listening to this.
Well, for us, it's quite late. And or early. So... but it being that time, I think we need to hand over to Alex to sign us off.
Well, you've been listening to Elite Cadre, the Hordes and War Machine podcast that had less naked than normal.
Yay!
I've been Alex.
I've been Mike.
I've been Kurt. And he's already gone.
He had to go and do other things that were more important.
More important.
Yes. Listening to Elite Cadre, a War Machine and Hordes podcast. Email us at elitecadrepodcast@gmail.com. Find the whole team on Twitter at bit.ly/elitecadre. Or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/elitecadre. Music provided by Martin DeBont and Symphony of Spectres. This podcast is part of the Muse on Minis network. Find out more at museonminis.com. And now, in a world of perfect production and seamless transitions, we bring you the chaos that lurks beneath the surface. These are the Easter eggs.
This is never about it. Never a good idea, because you're probably recording this anyway, you're not there. I'll talk to no one.
La 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 la.
Oh, hang on, outtakes, shit.
It's so dark that it sucks the light into it.
All right, calm down, emo boy.
No one understands him.
No one.
Anyway, should we start?
She did say this week, though, every time she sees a comment from me, she just goes, oh, what now? I thought that was quite funny.
Apparently, instead of a start, we have a carry-on. Hey!
Well, we can throw in the buses in if you like.
That is a bit even before my time. That's like, you know.
Some mothers do have them.
Well, I was thinking, you know, for the benefit of those people who have a bedtime.
And that's me.
Yes. And I want to be getting back to playing Fire Emblem, so, you know, as soon as possible.
Oh, yeah. No bedtime for you.
Hello and welcome to Elite Cadre, the Hordes of War Machine podcast that does itself too serious. Yes?
Before you go on any further, I haven't got bedtime either.
Okay.
Have you not? Are you not working tomorrow?
No, my mum says I can stay up till whenever I want.
As an irresponsible adult,
What's your children's response? What time do they say you can stay up to?
I don't give a fuck what my kids think about me.
What time do your children wake you up?
Oh, yes.
Same thing.
Yes.
Anyway,
moving on.
That ipso facto denotes a bedtime from a sanity point of view, if nothing else. Right, where are the small bases? I'm not going any further until I can find a small base.
I've got one right here, Kit.
Excellent, thank you.
I've got a bag here too. Here you go.
I found some as well. Thank you, move on.
I do need some medium bases for tomorrow, actually. Flags. Oh, actually, no, Tim's got that box of flags, hasn't he? I'll ask him to bring those.
Remind him to bring it.
Yeah. All the scenarios tomorrow are close quarters.
Great.
Also, if we don't finish in time for your train, I'll give you a lift home.
Not mosh pit?
Ooh, that sounds fun.
It's,
mosh pit?
No, close quarters.
Mosh pit?
Close quarters, battle box, half an 8 o'clock, go!
Quiet, Mr. Cather.
Anyway. Hello, and welcome to... really?
Just get on with it, please.
Twice in one show? Really? Really? We're doing this? Okay. Hello, and welcome to Elite Cadre.
Whenever you're ready, Mike.
Once more, and he'll explode.
It's your turn now, Nick. And you're the one who'll punch.
It's just the thought that I'm sat at a desk which is literally a collection of sharp things. I've got scissors, scalpels, a screwdriver.
You're going to email on us now, are you? You're going, if you just drop me again, I'm going to hurt myself.
I've also got car keys.
You don't know where you live. You know where Nick lives.
And he's not got a bedtime.
Oh, I have. Hang on. Whoa.
Okay. I'll just take a swig of tea, just to, you know, moisten the throat.
Nick, it's your turn this time.
Come on, Nick, your turn.
Nick.
Hello and welcome to Elite Cadre.
Come on. I knew I wouldn't have to do anything.
I had stopped.
I have stopped now, Mike. I'm very sorry. Everybody quiet. Move on. Come on. Be professional.
It's whimpering now. Who's typing?
Sorry, that was a bit hard. It was me.
Good.
Dear,
he's muted now. We can hear him. We can hear him mute. How lovely.
You hear the click?
Yes.
Oh, that's weird. Where do you hear the click?
Because you always hear the click.
Yeah.
You just never notice it normally.
No, we just ignore it normally.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Like we do you.
Fair enough.
This is weird.
What?
A 1968 kids comic book version of 2001.
Oh.
My mind cannot process this.
I don't know when the year the book came out. I thought it was 69, but can't be.
Book may have been 69, but the film was earlier than the book, despite the fact they were being done at the same...
Yeah, I'm aware that that was the case, yeah.
The film was 68.
What?
Only at 94 in the IMDb top 100, top 250, rather.
Yeah. Yeah, but IMDb's a funny one for votes.
It's got a lot of films in the top 100 that you're like, yeah, okay.
Because it's open to public votes, so a lot of Muppets vote for crap. Really, that's what it is, I think.
Let's see, where's the first obvious crap film?
Titanic?
No, that's not in even the top 20.
Is there nothing really shit in the top 20?
I'm actually going to go with the first film that I really dislike. Is it number 26?
I'm not going to look now, aren't I?
With The Usual Suspects?
I like that film a lot.
I've watched it twice, and I'm like, I don't get why people like this.
Oh, it's lovely. It's awesome. IMDb top 250. What? Shawshank. See, I'm not the world's biggest fan of Shawshank, and that's number one.
Yeah. I think that's a case.
Oh, why is Godfather 2? Why is Godfather 2 underneath Godfather 1? What?
I've not watched the second one, sir.
It's way better. Pulp Fiction should not be 4.
Oh, 12 Angry Men. Dark Knight, Schindler's List, Lord of the Rings. There was a weird top ten. It's a very strange top ten.
Yeah.
Empire is in the right place. Yeah, Empire should be about 11. That's where it belongs, regardless of what's above it. Fellowship. So Return of the King above... Really? Fellowship of the Ring, I think, is the best of the trilogy. One for the Cuckoo's Nest.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know what it is about it. It just...
Return of the King does start to drag a little.
See, what I mean. I prefer Fellowship of the Ring is the better of the trilogy for me. Because it's all the group together. It's a bit like the difference between the old Star Wars and the new ones. The old ones are about a group of them striving together, sacrificing each other, putting each other before themselves. It's really heartwarming, which is what Fellowship's about. Whereas the original trilogy, the part 1, 2, and 3 are about Anakin, whiny child. And to an extent, that's what Return of the King is. To an extent, not he's not whiny child, but it becomes they all end up in isolation. The Matrix needs to go a lot further down because it was really good, but it isn't anymore.
Oh, I've tried rewatching it. It's yeah,
it was amazing, but it's not anymore. Once more time in the West.
Well, what it was is it took a lot of Hong Kong blood opera stuff and combined it with some pretty well-trodden sci-fi and did it in a really nice way.
Oh no! See, you should go find the first thing you read. Like, why the fuck is Forrest Gump 18?
What? No, that's Forrest Gump. It's a great film.
It's not.
It is. Yeah. It is brilliant.
It's really not.
Ah, you're wrong.
It's probably my favourite film.
Oh, I just don't. I don't know.
Kurt may explode at any second. There.
It's just not.
Stand well back.
It's not. It's just. I don't kind of. I like touching films and emotionally triggering and engaging films, and that's none of those things for me. I know it's what it's trying to be, but
why is Howl's Moving Castle even on this list?
I quite like that film.
If you're gonna pick a Miyazaki, that's not the one.
No, you're right. I agree. If you're gonna make Hayao Miyazaki, then there are a lot much better ones. I agree. Fucking Totoro for a start.
Yeah.
But Totoro is. Because it's a kids' film, but it's such a good kids' film. It doesn't get rated because it's a kids' film. Well, but it's such a good film.
I can't think of a Miyazaki I've seen that I would rate below it.
Below what?
Below Howl's Moving Castle.
Yeah, that's a really difficult thing to say, isn't it? Because Howl's Moving Castle is really good.
I would still watch it in preference to a lot of other films.
But what would you put below it? Maybe Ponyo, but Ponyo is still quite nice.
I've not seen Ponyo.
It's one of the newest ones that is aimed at young children again. It's aimed at like 5-year-olds.
Well, I've seen His Borrowers and I really enjoyed that.
But Ponyo is Little Mermaid.
Yeah. And it's like, well, there's Kiki's Delivery Service, and I enjoyed that.
I think I'd put Howl's above Kiki, because Kiki is quaint, but it's nothing much happens.
No, but my daughter loves it.
It's a little girl's film. My daughter loves Kiki, but it's Kiki, you know.
But this list has Nausicaa.
I love Nausicaa.
It below Howl's Moving Castle. Amazing. Yes!
Well, and the dub has got Patrick Stewart in it.
Yes! It's just.
Would you realise when he made that as well? You're like, how long ago did you record that? Before you did Star Trek? What the fuck?
Didn't he do the redo dub though? That was like 1990-something.
I thought it was the original American dub, because bear in mind, he's in like Dune before Star Trek in 1984 as well. So he was doing that kind of stuff, but Rear Windows 28, Rear Windows is an awesome film. See, what else is in here that's... I don't know. I've not seen City of God, I'll be honest. That's the first film I'm going down the list that I've not watched.
What number's that?
City of God is 21. I've not watched 21. I've not watched...
Actually, I only get to number 6 with 12 Angry Men.
I watched it years ago. I haven't watched it in a very long time. I'm familiar with what it is about and its concepts and things, and it's Graham Greene, I think, isn't it, by 12 Angry Men? Mm. Sunset Boulevard, never watched that.
Stuff like Big Fish, although I really like that film, I'm not sure it needs to be on the...
Where's Big
250?
Fish?
249.
Oh, it's a long way down then.
Yeah.
Saving Private Ryan. Yeah, see, I know. That didn't do much for me either. Don't get me wrong. I hate Tom Hanks. I hate Tom Hanks, but I just don't really get that film.
You're just going to pick up on Tom Hanks films all the way through, aren't you?
City Lights. I don't know what City Lights is.
No.
Spirited Away is 41.
Which is deserved, I think.
North by Northwest is 42. That's got to be in the teens, for fuck's sake. North by Northwest. Hitchcock's action movie. The template for all... Oh, Charlie Chaplin, City Lights. The template for all modern action movies is 42. Django jumps into 45. Wow. Back to the Future's 46. Meh.
See, skipping over Citizen Kane.
Okay.
I think Citizen Kane's in about the right place, actually. I think it's
probably want to put it about 30.
It's so good, but it's far more movie buff porn than it is great film.
That's fair. And you could argue, I suppose, to an extent, North and Northwest in a similar fashion, because what's great about both of them is they changed cinema.
Mm.
Both of them had an effect on cinema.
Yeah.
In a kind of a Watchmen for comics kind of thing, the way that changes what goes on around them.
Okay. Departed at 50. Okay.
So where's Infernal Affairs?
Oh, I think Departed's a better film.
Ah. What, because it's one film instead of two?
Infernal Affairs is like Departed's like 1.5 of Infernal Affairs.
Where's Twilight Atlas?
It's almost both, isn't it? It's almost both films. It's almost both films. I'd argue not quite everything, but
hang on, there's three Infernal Affairs films.
Oh, I was going to say it was one and two, isn't it? Yes, which is what you just said, really, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's got a good chunk of two.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I was thinking of one and two, and it's almost all of one and two.
Where does Twilight come on the list?
It doesn't. I just think...
Chinatown is 83, and then Old Boy is 84. Chinatown is one of my favourite films ever. Chinatown's in my top 10, it has to be. Have you seen Chinatown?
No.
Watch Chinatown. Quietly, and when you can concentrate. It's a fantastic movie. It's brilliant.
See, I'm just glad that one of my top 10 is actually on the list, which I'm quite surprised is there. At number 144, there is The Thing.
The Thing, the original John Carpenter?
The second one.
Sorry, that's a contradiction. Do you mean the John Carpenter, The Thing?
Yeah. I just love that film.
I like that film a lot as well. I like John Carpenter. I like Big Trouble Little China when it's on.
Yeah, no, that's good fun.
Mononoke's 92.
There are some notable John Carpenter exceptions, though.
Vampires?
I'm thinking of, what was the name of it? Oh, okay. That was it. Ghosts of Mars?
Yeah, it's a bit of a stinker.
Debatably Escape from L.A. I really enjoy it, but I know it's very much this isn't a great film.
That was the first film I saw in full THX. In Toronto, I saw that in THX. A Separation. I've never seen that. What's that? A married couple face to improve the life of the child. Oh, I have heard of that, but I've never seen it. And that's... Okay. That's like 105. Yojimbo is 106. Yay. So how many of the Yojimbo clones are above it? How many of the Yojimbo clones are above it? None?
Yojimbo is Kurosawa, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's been remade more than almost any film.
Pan's Labyrinth should be a bit higher.
Is Seven Samurai on there?
Yeah, Seven Samurai is 17.
Yeah.
Seven Samurai has probably been remade more than Yojimbo, hasn't it? But Yojimbo has been quietly remade at least three times.
Well, Magnificent Seven is Yojimbo, Seven Samurai.
So is Battle Beyond the Stars. I'm sure there are others. But Yojimbo is Fistful of Dollars and also Last Man Standing are both Yojimbo. Not vaguely, they're almost scene for scene. Well, subtle differences, but they're all scene for scene remakes. Including the big get him locked up in the barrel house, the big barrel crashes into him is in all three. There aren't any rabbits in the remakes, though. Actually, Mike, you might know this. Yojimbo, yes. Is the rabbit comic the first version?
I've never seen Yojimbo, so...
Okay, so have you seen Last Man Standing, Bruce Willis' film? It's
not ringing any bells, actually.
Last Man Standing is Prohibition, kind of outside of Chicago, and it's basically a remake of Fistful of Dollars, but the original is Yojimbo, a samurai wandering in to defend this village against these idiots and stuff and getting himself caught up in stuff he can't really give himself out of. Yojimbo is the original.
Are you trying to think of Usagi Yojimbo as well?
What's that?
It's a version of Yojimbo, which is a bunny, I think.
Well, that's what I mean. It's a comic, isn't it? I'm not sure which is first. Oh, I think probably Yojimbo, the original film, is the first one because it's 61 and it's written by Akira Kurosawa. That's probably the clue there, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, Last Man Standing, remake of Yojimbo and A Fistful of Dollars.
Yeah. Yeah, geek out, movie time.
Yeah.
It's quite a good list once we've done that, going, no. Oh, just some awesome films to look at. Avengers Assemble, 150. Yeah, it belongs there. Totoro is 158. V for Vendetta is 160. Oh, that's an awesome movie.
Is Total Recall on there?
Which version?
Arnie.
I don't very much doubt it.
It's a good film.
No, it isn't.
No, I should have searched Recall as well. Fight Club's 10. That's an awesome place for that to be.
That is a good film.
Terminator 2 at 36 as well.
Yeah, that kind of belongs there in a way.
But that's one that I maintain is as close as you'll pretty much find to the perfect action movie.
I don't know how you define that as a concept.
It's got that sort of, it's got a little bit of meaning behind it. It's got some great action scenes. Everything kind of holds together plot-wise, which...
There are no big clangs like there are in Terminator 3.
And it's got, even with James Cameron doing some really weird stuff, some absolutely cracking special effects that hold up.
They do, because they mix, again, the best special effects are the ones that mix special effects. So the fact that they mix the whole kind of foil suit, 3D animatronics with CG.
There's one bit near the start, which you watch, and you sort of, your 21st century brain goes, well, that's clearly CG. And if you watch if you watch the making of, it's one guy with a hand puppet standing in front of a rear projection.
Oh, is that the That's
the opening scene when they've got the all metal Terminators walking over the battlefield.
Yeah,
it's one guy with a half Terminator torso puppet, and then all the background is rear projected, and they just filmed the rear projection.
Wow. I think I've seen it, but I didn't remember it was that kind of...
The other one as well is the surgery scene where they're doing the chip in Arnie's head.
The only bits in that film that are CG are the morphing metal T-1000.
Yeah. Well, the mirror they actually did with Linda Hamilton's twin.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
There's no glass in the mirror, and there's one of them on both sides, and they've got a dummy of Arnie on one side and Arnie himself on the other.
Mm.
And once you realise that that's what they're doing, it's like, oh, yeah. That's really cool.
Is, oh shit, I can ask you. Oh, Ronin, is that on the list?
Yeah, I saw it. Leon is, sorry, I always mix the two together. Leon is 31. I don't know if Ronin is.
Oh, Ronin is not?
Oh, that's the last great car chase.
It's
a good car chase. What?
No.
They're terrible cars, but it's a good chase.
A8.
That was like the golden age of European muscle car.
The A8 was where he gets his souped up A8 with fucking nitrous and stuff in it. It's just like, oh my god, that's an awesome car.
And I can't remember who his name is. The guy who's in Avengers and Thor is in that as well, isn't he? In Ronin.
The guy who's in Avengers?
What? The scientist from Avengers and Thor.
Yes, he is. Yeah, he is. He's in that Deep Blue Sea thing with the sharks as well. Yes. He's in Hunt for October as well.
He's also in Mamma Mia.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, Stellan Skarsgård.
Yeah, that's him. Yeah, he's in Hunt for October. He's Tupolev.
Yes, he's the guy who...
Tupolev.
Yeah, the guy whose neck gets broken early on, isn't it?
Nope. He's the guy captain of the other ship.
Anyone
but Tupolev. He's the guy who knows Ramius really well and is chasing him. Accounted to orders, he's just chasing him because he knows something's up.
It's a role that's much bigger in the book than it is in the film. But to be honest, if they went into it in the depth that it is in the book...
I think it carried quite well in the film, though. I do like that film a lot.
You got enough of it in the film, but that film could quite easily have been like 4.5 hours long.
I kind of read that book by proxy because when my mum was reading that book when I was a teenager... She got so excited over it, she would just tell me tons of stuff that's happening through that book as she was reading it. So I never read it, but I know more about the story than is in the film.
Yeah. Well, it's Tom Clancy. It's one of those sort of...
I'm not a big fan of reading Tom Clancy.
Tom Clancy is...
Donnie Darko is 177.
He can't write a short book.
No. Donnie Darko is 177.
I think that may be the effect of the sequel, dragging it down.
Oh, nobody's watched that.
No, no one's watched it exactly.
Nobody's watched that. That's just, oh God. I don't even want to think about it.
That was one of those things. It's like, they're making a sequel to Donnie Darko.
What? There's no such thing. It's worse. I don't even know what's...
Out of interest, is Napoleon Dynamite on the list?
If it is, it shouldn't be. It's one of those films like Superbad that I got about half an hour in and just went... No, I can't watch this anymore. I'm not going to watch this. I have more important things to do with my life.
There's quite a big difference between Superbad and Napoleon Dynamite, to my mind.
They're both pretty bad.
They are, but Superbad... Napoleon Dynamite, I just don't get. Superbad, I found quite funny. I haven't decided to watch it again. See, The Hustler is only 194. That seems low. It's below the Princess Bride.
Oh, The Princess Bride is a good film.
It is a really good film.
It's a fun film.
Well, it's one of those first sort of almost postmodern family films. It was a little bit of a precursor to some of the humour in things like Shrek.
Oh, Shrek did, yeah, definitely. Yeah, kind of borrowing from it, didn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's sort of nodding and winking at the typical kids stroke family film.
It's interesting because it's just who votes for IMDb, generally anyone, and it's a strange kind of...
It's a hive mind that has created that list.
Yeah, and it's who votes as well. It's part of it as well, because my mum doesn't vote. I don't vote. You know, it's kind of who votes, who actually goes into, who registers on IMDb and votes for their movies.
I'm registered on IMDb, but that was only so I could keep the original version of IMDb's interface.
Rather, you can't say it's a combination of everybody's opinion, because there's a dynamic there of what kind of person goes on and rates their films on IMDb.
There's also going to be a lot of waiting in it due to the fact that some people will just go on and go, I like this movie, 10. This one sucked, 0. And it's like,
that should balance itself in theory.
Well, it's the kind of people who sit there and vote 0 for Citizen Kane. It's like, what do you want?
There wasn't enough colour in it.
In fact, let's have a look at the breakdown of the votes. 2.8% of people have voted 1 for Citizen Kane.
The IMDb editors have taken a view that these people's votes do not count and hence will not be included.
Really? Is that what you just read? That sounded very formal. I liked it.
It sounded official enough.
It really did sound very official. He was using his work telephone voice, wasn't he?
Well, I hate to break in.
Can I be held accountable for anything said by the members of his staff? You, sir, are a cunt.
I hate to break into this, but
we should record a podcast.
Yeah, should we do the second?
I just stopped looking at the screen and started painting again. So yeah, knock yourself out. Here is a brief blog.